You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Angela Merkel can nearly call herself a four-term chancellor. The CDU okay the Grand Coalition. Will their prospective partners do the same? My guests Isabel Hilton and Alessio Patilano will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including China's President Xi Jinping. What would he do with 20 years that he couldn't do in 10? Can Brussels tackle air pollution by making public transport free? And
that is also why today I'm announcing that I will reinstate the cabinet position of Minister of Disarmament and Arms Control.
Will the world put its guns down because New Zealand tells it to? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Alessio Patilano, lecturer in war studies at King's College London. Welcome both. Now, first of all, it has taken nearly 6 months since their last election, but Angela Merkel is now all but confirmed as a four-term chancellor of Germany. As expected, delegates at her Christian Democratic Union Party's conference have voted by a thumping margin to reanimate the previous grand coalition with the Social Democrats. However, there is still a chance that it might not go ahead. Results of a postal vote on the deal by Social Democrat members are due to be announced on Sunday. This is all good fun, isn't it, Isabel? Is there any chance that the Social Democrat membership says no? Or, should I say nein? That's the pretty much the limit of
vielleicht.
We have reached the limit of my German, certainly. So let's just, let's carry on.
I wouldn't entirely rule it out.
Really?
I mean, I think you have a number of things going on in Germany. One is obviously the fear of the far right and the understandable reluctance to give them another go at increasing their electoral grip by precipitating an election. So if this coalition doesn't happen, there will be elections again in Germany, and we could assume that Alternative für Deutschland would grow at that point. And I think that the kind of bigger picture is that you see, much as you see in other countries in Europe, a kind of wandering in the wilderness of the social democratic core. So you know, the SPD has not done very well in the past few years. Junior coalition partners do not do very well, famously. They get blamed for failing to impose their agenda. They don't get credit for the bits of the agenda that they do manage to impose. And the dominant party in any coalition takes credit for any popular policies and tends to blame the junior partners. So it's even a grand coalition, even with significant posts such as that have been offered to the SPD, carries risks. The SPD itself is in a mess with its leadership. You know, there has been discontent, and there's a movement rather similar to the one that selected Jeremy Corbyn as Britain's potential savior in Germany too. You know, a desire for clearer ideological definition. So you have on the right, you have the Alternative für Deutschland, which is attracting Christian Democrats who feel that Merkel is too centrist. And on the left, you have people pushing for a much clearer definition of a socialist alternative. So it's possible that they could, that there will be enough people in the Social Democratic Party that have an appetite for a straightforward fight.
Alessio, you, of course, also come from a country with a long tradition of coalition governments and likely to be facing a round of coalition wrangles imminently. Are things like this an argument for or against coalition governments as an idea, do you think?
Against. Hands down. I wouldn't think about it longer than, you know, than microseconds. I think... So in Germany, it's probably different. I mean, the question is not the coalition in itself, is where the coalition comes from in the political system. Because when the coalition government took shape here, it was coming from within a political system that doesn't do coalitions. And in fact, lots of contradictions came out, and it was a mishmash of things that didn't work out too well. In fact, it worked terribly for the Lib Dem, that did very badly in the subsequent elections. countries where the political systems is accustomed to have coalitions, the implications for a government doesn't do too well and as radical. If you look at Italy or if you look at Germany, parties come and go. There is almost a sense among the electorate that a coalition is okay, is part of the normality of the political process. How much that generates effective governance is an entirely different question. And I think in Germany has worked until recently, but I think at the moment, Isabel is absolutely right. Germany is going through, like the rest of most of continental Europe, a generational change. We're moving from the previously existing and currently existing political systems seems to have failed at some point. The electorate hasn't quite understood what the next generation will be looking like. Now, interestingly, in Germany, this election has also provided or planted the seeds for the next generation of people to come into power. Whether we like the kind of leadership that is emerging is a different question, but I think there are new names coming up. The fact that Merkel has decided to bring Jens Spahn into her government. He's 37, he's by far the youngest person.
He's very critical of her.
He's extremely critical. I think that's a very interesting point because it shows that she knows this is the end of a time. Something else will have to come out of this. Even her sort of successor within the CDU would suggest that this is an era that is coming to an end. So I think the coalition will take place, is likely to take place, but what really is interesting is how much of the spirit of government will see the emergence of the next wave, because Germany is an important actor in Europe, and so eyes will be pointed at them to see whether this next generation of leadership is going to be a bit better than the one that we've seen emerging in other countries, probably bar France.
I mean, it is a weird thought, isn't it, Isabel, to be sort of discussing at the outset, or almost certain, or likelier than not, outset of somebody's government. But a big feature of this term of Angela Merkel's, if that's what's about to happen, is going to be contemplation of what post-Merkel Germany looks like.
And that is going to
take some getting used to, because it's not just that she does now. It now feels like she's been there since the earth cooled. It's the fact that she has been, or we've become accustomed to thinking of her in the last 3 or 4 years as this fixed point of, you know,
perhaps the only one.
Or perhaps the only fixed point of you know, sanity and reliability.
Yes.
The old order, yes.
Yeah, I think that's
that liberal democrat thing you were talking about.
Indeed. And I, you know, you can, this clearly this thought has occurred to her. And as Alessio says, you know, you can see the moves being put in place for some kind of transition that might answer the electorate's anxieties without descending into, you know, chaos in Germany of a kind that nobody wants to see. But she will most certainly be missed. I think, you know, the entire world is going to have to come to terms with the loss of this, you know, extraordinary politician who also, you remember, you know, was a symbol of the success of the unification of Germany. She's you know, a pastor's daughter from the East.
Indeed.
You know, she became the most successful Chancellor in the West. But the other thing, just to go back to your question of whether coalitions were always bad or always failed, you know, part of the, it depends on the coalition. You've had many, many different types. Grand coalitions are not necessarily the dominant pattern in Germany. And one of the things that's changed in Germany is the shrinking of the Liberal Party, who are always kind of, you know, 4 or 5% and always had the foreign ministry. And, you know, that was a kind of stable coalition partner for the CDU. Or in Berlin, you had red-green coalitions that were effective. So you have had coalitions in Germany, either at provincial or at city level, or sometimes at national level, where you have a closer ideological alignment. You know, a grand coalition is kind of, you know, the two big beasts from notionally opposite sides of the political spectrum, and that always is uncomfortable.
Okay, well, let's move seamlessly from a leader who was probably starting her last term to a leader who was supposed to be halfway through his. However, it appears increasingly the case that President Xi Jinping of China believes that his mandated maximum of 10 years may be insufficient. The Communist Party appears keen to abolish presidential term limits, clearing the way for, if not president for life, Xi, then certainly president for the foreseeable future. it does seem like a weird question, Isabel, to be asking this late. He's been there a while now. But what do we actually know about him, and what might have informed him to start thinking, maybe I don't want to go just yet?
Well, one reason not to go just yet is he's made so many enemies. and he's also broken that taboo against going after your enemies once they leave office. So frankly, I mean, I have felt ever since he went after Zhou Yongkang, the head of the security services, who was an extraordinarily powerful, you know, ex-standing committee Politburo figure, I thought, it's not going to be safe to step down. So that's number one. But there's another aspect to the question, which is, you know, where does Xi Jinping's power really lie? And it lies in his party post, which has no term limit anyway. He's general secretary of the Communist Party. And what he's done over the past, in the past 5 years, is to reinsert what was a failing, flagging, sagging institution into the center of every aspect of life in China. So today, if you run a private business, you have to have a party cell. And the party cell will tell you, you know, that actually you have to prop up this zombie state-owned enterprise. It will tell you all kinds of things. The party's demanding equity and positions on the board in private business. The party is back in terms of defining a national ideology. When he came to power, you know, the only reason to join the party was for rent-seeking or for access to power. Nobody joined because they believed in communism, however it was defined, and everyone had forgotten how it was defined. What he's done is to impose Xi Jinping thought, which is really, you know, it's about making China great again, and eternal rule by the party. And that's quite an achievement. I don't think it's a particularly good one for China, but it's quite an achievement. And he has dismantled... You know, China could have gone in the other direction. It could have gone down the rule of law, the sharing of power, the progress towards a more open society. That is definitely not the path it's taken. All of that has been closed down. So you have no rule of law. You have effectively the party. Effectively, law is what I say it is. And, you know, I am the party and party is China. So, you know, there is no crack in this edifice.
It is all getting, well, it's getting a bit Charles de Gaulle, really, the whole I am the state is me, which I won't attempt to render in my French, which is arguably even worse than my German. But Alessio, is there not a difficult trajectory that the president has now put the Communist Party on? Because for all that he has revived it, or at least that it has revived under his watch, if you put one person at the top of any institution and it becomes clear that they are there forever and immovable, does it not have a kind of calcifying effect on the rest of the organisation as people start to realise that there is a limit on my ambitions here and start to drift away? Does the Communist Party become a victim of its own power in that respect?
Well, it depends. I think it is true to the extent to which the party has been reformed, as Isabel was saying, and he's putting in place in key places and key position across the echelons all people that are very loyal to him. Xi Jinping is coming from a family background whereby he goes, you know, in his family there is an understanding of what the party is about, that is very much this extended family. You know, when you go to Shaoshan and you visit the museum of the Mao's village and you look at Mao's, there's a reconstruction of Mao's personal chambers, and on all the shelves, the main books are all about Qing dynasty, it's about imperial politics. Xi Jinping comes from the same cloak in that sense. He's a guy who understands that China needs a strong ruler. You know, put it this way, someone like Xi Jinping understands very much that besides all this idea that you have to have China, the concept of China, identify with one single person and the two come together to give this sense of monolithic unity, is to hide the more important truth, that is, China is an extremely diverse and composite place. It's a continent. It's like taking, you know, Europe and transform it into one single state in that sense. The challenge that anyone that wants to control and commands China has always been to keep it together. Now, how do you do that? By giving it a strong sense of unity and leadership and put a face, a totem. Mao's portrait still hangs in the middle of Tiananmen Square to the present day. I think he's moving towards that direction, and everything that he does, he's precisely and carefully designed to project that image. I'll give you an example that really shocked me, and this is that goes down to the nerdiness of my expertise. But a few months back, I was actually quite impressed. As you know, that last year where there was the celebration of the PLAs, the famous sort of parade. This was the first time they was going around not with the usual traditional party dressing, you know, the Mao collar shirts. He was going around the parade. He was reviewing the troops as commander-in-chief wearing a full camouflage. And over the following few weeks, every single time he was visiting a senior military command, he was always in military attire. Mm. Now, the interesting thing was that whenever there was a picture with generals next to him, he was the only one that really was properly dressed as a military person. I'll give an example. The boot laces, right? They were not done properly for the generals. He was the only one who had the proper boot laces done. And you think to yourself, hang on a second, you know, this is not an accident. This doesn't happen like that. He was the only one that, notwithstanding the fact that he doesn't really look like as fit as, you know, fighting fit type of person, he was the only one that looked properly martial.
But do you think he had someone go around untying the bootlaces?
No, I think there was someone that was ensuring
that his
looked correct. That he was looking the commanding figure in any single image. When you go after that type of level of details, it says something about the fact that you want to provide that type of like center or gravity around which the nation can gravitate. Again, he did the same thing with the 19th Party Congress, whereby he was the commanding figure, you know, the absolutely challenging 3-hour speech, you know, without relinquishing his power to talk. These are all signs of someone that has understood this fundamental truth, that leadership and centrality of his figure is absolutely essential for the party to remain where it is. On the back of this, the point that Isabel was making about the party reactivating itself in this regard is absolutely true. It's true even in universities, where the political appointees that operate at university level, the various echelons of the university management, if you want, they are much more proactive these days, and we see that in interactions. In the last couple of years, we've actually seen when foreign universities from China sort of come to visit. It does. Usually, there's always the senior political appointee from the party that comes
yes,
and speaks to
and
that.
And there also, I mean, when the last time there was a leader who embodied China in that way was Mao, and China was shut off from the outside world, and the party's story was unchallenged, except internally. Now you've got a China which is out in the world, and one of the things that you see increasingly is that the party's attempt to control the narrative about the party and
Absolutely.
About China, not only in China, but in Western
Outside.
Universities, in Western media, in, you know, you have a huge push to make sure that the China story is the party's version of the China story, and that no other story flourishes. And this is a real problem, I think, for Western academic freedom, for Western media, and for Western values.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Alessio Patalano and Isabel Hilton. Coming up next, an addition, or re-addition as it turns out, to the political world's lexicon of obscure portfolios.
From the rise of pet furniture to a raft of new museums and a fresh breed of political provocateurs, there are plenty of reasons to look forward to 2018. Luckily, we've packed lots of them into more than 200 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's a magazine for those who want to look beyond the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. We'll look at the political conversations you'll be having, the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. The Forecast is packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2018.
You're back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Alessio Patalano. Now, as long ago as 1990, France endowed one of its cabinet ministers with responsibility for French rock music, prompting some to respond that this was perhaps equivalent to being named squadron leader of the Dutch Mountain Rescue Service. This week, the militantly inoffensive nation of New Zealand tempts similar derision by creating and or reviving a ministerial position for disarmament, eliciting further hilarity. The role will be taken by Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters, not a politician known for a generally placid demeanour. Isabel, what do we imagine that a Minister for Disarmament, especially New Zealand's Minister for Disarmament, is actually going to do all day?
Well, I think it's pretty much a, you know, one day a month job, isn't it?
One day a month, I reckon you can phone this in before lunchtime.
It depends who he's trying to disarm, and maybe we should reinterpret this. You know, maybe he's there to create social harmony, you know, disarming angry people. I don't know.
Again, there is a long career of evidence to suggest that that is perhaps not Winston Peters' strong suit. Perhaps they're going to start small. They'll start by disarming, I don't know, Tuvalu and the Cook Islands, and then work their way up,
yeah.
Do we know where the rings of the Lord of the Rings are located at the moment? Because it could be that they want to sort of track them down and start demobilising from there.
Or it could be that, as Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says, and I suppose we should take her word for it, that the portfolio I'm quoting here is an acknowledgement of the emphasis this government places on our long-held anti-nuclear stance and the role we must play now and in the future. Alessio, do you imagine that there are many nuclear-armed countries that are going to be especially interested in what New Zealand thinks on this front?
Well, I mean, you know, we shouldn't rule things out off the bat, I would say. I would say certainly that's unlikely. But at the same time, I think we live in a very difficult age insofar as the Asia-Pacific is on the verge, is on the cusp. It could become an extremely nuclearized part of the world, and notwithstanding all the rhetoric in the United States, we have to start to come to terms with the fact that you could have very soon a nuclear, even if it's not officially recognized, North Korea, which raises all sorts of questions about South Korea and Japan. So if you're in New Zealand, I can understand why from a liberal point of view you want to revive that debate. Whether or not other people are going to pick it up because it's coming from New Zealand, that's a different story.
I mean, from New Zealand's point of view, there's a historical context to this, which was New Zealand leading protests against French nuclear testing in the South Pacific for many years, which of course resulted in the grotesque spectacle of the French blowing up a Greenpeace boat in Auckland Harbour, I think, if memory serves correctly. Is this a symbolic gesture, Isabel? And if so, is it still a gesture worth making?
I think it's always a gesture worth making. I mean, we live in a kind of rhetorical universe of belligerence right now between North Korea and the United States, and then the newly muscular China, and the general anxieties about geostrategic shifts. So I think a reminder. It's a bit like the school children in the United States who are suddenly standing up for the right not to be shot, to everyone's astonishment. You know. I think the right to discuss a world that has, you know, that considers denuclearization, which after all, you know, 15 years ago was regarded as a positive thing. I think it's good to be reminded of that. And you know, perhaps New Zealand can stand as a kind of little moral case there.
I mean, Alessio, just more widely, is there a point to making these appointing people to portfolios which have a slightly, well, just a non-traditional aspect? The UK, for example, recently appointed a minister with responsibility for loneliness.
That's just to look after Theresa May. Well,
which did prompt a measure of hilarity of that sort, Isabel. But, you know, and I just, and also, you know, prompted the idea of just this one minister just going around and knocking on people's doors and saying, "Hi, you fancy a chat?" But it is a thing. You know, yes. It is a thing which has become a thing anyway, and do we need to adapt the idea of what government is responsible for, rather?
I think as societies evolve, of course, there is a question to be raised about having creating new positions that put some sort of the spotlight over the issue and try to see whether and to what extent governments should engage with it. I believe that actually is very true. If you think about it, every single state has a different social contract, a different arrangement between the body politic and the people they are interacting with and they're responsible for. Think about South Korea and North Korea. South Korea, of course, having a Ministry of Unification. You know, not many countries have a Ministry of Unification. But if you think about the context of the Korean Peninsula, it makes perfect sense.
Taiwan, brilliantly, and I met the minister responsible at the time, has something I think rather coyly referred to as the Minister for Mainland Affairs.
Yes,
or something of that sort.
Absolutely. So, you know, depending where you are, depending on the social contract, what the people are asking you to look after, you have a responsibility to come up with relevant assignments in that regard. Now, whether it is the Ministry of Loneliness or the Ministry of Happiness, which I think would be a very good idea in a world that is becoming incredibly sad, right? That's open to discussion. But I think
there is a Vice Minister of Supreme Social Happiness, guess where? In Venezuela. Appointed by Nicolas Maduro. So the unfortunate thing about
there's a minister who's working overtime right now.
Absolutely. There tends to be, these ideas tend to be floated just at the moment when the economy is about to tank or, you know, people are about to be deeply unhappy.
Okay, well, we should move finally along to Brussels, where from now on days when the air cannot be breathed, it won't cost anything to get away from it. Local authorities have ruled that if they have two consecutive days of sufficiently suboptimal air quality, buses, trams and metros will stop taking fares. Alessio, is this going to help, or is this just the government of Brussels trying to make people less angry on days when they can't go outside and inhale?
I really cannot see the direct correlation between not being there to go on public transport and your air quality suddenly improving. So I would probably go for the latter. But then, you know, I'm just a simple academic. I try to make correlation among cause and effect.
I mean, they are also on those days, they will cut car speed limits by a third and ban wood-burning stoves.
I think they have to cut cars to make any difference.
Exactly.
This seems to me dancing around the problem of a congestion charge or a low emission zone or any of the actually rather well-tried methods that do have some impact on air quality. And there's no point in making public transport free if it's not already adequate, desirable, and gets you where you want to go.
I think that's the key point. As in, that would make sense if you know that the public transport network will automatically make people think, oh, I don't have to use my car, I'm going to go and use public transport. Now, I don't know the situation about Brussels, but from what I remember from a couple of years ago, it's very good to travel inside Brussels, right. But if you're coming from the outskirts...
And a lot of people live in those peripheral villages.
It's not going to help make a big difference. So in that sense, I think there is a disconnect between the initiative, that could be a very good initiative, and the reality on the ground. The two needs to go hand in hand, otherwise you're just dancing around the issue.
Well, if you think back to what happened in London with the congestion charge at the same time as Ken Livingstone introduced that, he also invested enormously in public transport and in bus lanes and ensuring that, you know, so he restricted private traffic, but he gave the road space to public transport and cut the fares. And that actually had quite a big effect. It was quite a brave thing to do at the time.
Say whatever else you will about Livingstone made the trains run on time.
Well, he made the buses run, actually. I'm sure the newts are happy.
Alessio, is this move in Brussels, though, is it a straw in the unbreathable wind? Are we going to start seeing more drastic measures of this sort in response to pollution?
No, I think that is definitely the case, unless you start planning ahead. And I must admit, you know, London, in that sense, is incredibly interesting place because when you compare it to other cosmopolitan capitals world over, most notably New York, the amount of effort done to make public transport the real alternative to actually help air being more breathable and address the question of pollution, you haven't seen in many other places the world over. So I think drastic measures will have to be seen. And I guess that places where this issue will become particularly cogent are places like China and India, where the average yearly sort of pollution rates are so high that you wonder how people ever go out of their houses.
But there, London, we should point out, doesn't meet its air quality standards. But I think this problem will eventually be solved by electric cars.
Absolutely.
Because London's problem is essentially diesel.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Isabel Hilton and Alessio Patilano, thank you both for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Kitchen. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900, it's Section D with Josh Fennett, and there's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns, of course, at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.